You have this story of these guys who are in the sailboat, and they see Jesus walking upon the water, right? Did they expect him? No, he is unexpected. So what does that mean in terms of their perception? They're already terrified. Why are they terrified? There's a storm, right? So they're afraid. These guys are afraid. They're in a boat. It's scary, which is saying something for these dudes, because you got the Sons of Thunder and Peter, who frankly shouldn't be terrified. They really have no reason in our estimation to be afraid, and yet they are, because it's a very significant environmental struggle that they're in at this moment. They feel that they're going to be overcome in the middle of this sea or this large lake, and then all of a sudden, unexpectedly, Jesus comes walking on the water. So you're already in a spirit of fear. Here's the thing. I know we're in a season of scares, right? Season of scares. It's astounding to me how this process works. They want to get you worked up, and in fact, there's a whole long story. There was this haunted house that I was curious about because it was put on by a church. And so my curiosity sometimes gets the best of me. I'm like, what is this thing? And so I went there to sort of get a sense of what they were trying to accomplish. And they immediately, they have these little preteen girls that are sort of signing people up to walk through this thing. And they wanted so bad to make me scared. Just even in the line, they're like, man, we've had guys that are just as big as you who've not made it through. I'm like, really? Really? Just as big as me, huh? Wow. Yeah, I think one guy even, I don't know, but he had to go home and change his pants. It was that scary. And they're like, interesting. They want to already sort of get you, this is going to be creepy. And I said, well, I appreciate the sales job, ladies. Good luck. And we took off. But the fact is that you think about that, you're already sort of in the spirit of like anticipation. Like, oh, this is going to be scary. This is going to be scary. And then you have, in the case of these guys in the boat, they're all like, oh, this is a scary situation. And suddenly Jesus comes walking on the water. That'd be terrifying. Frankly, that would be absolutely horrifically terrifying. And that's what we know is true, right? What does it say that they were, how did they respond when they saw that? You guys recall from the story? They thought it was a ghost. And they're scared. And Jesus says, calm down, it's me. And what was Peter's response? Oh, man. If it's you, ask me to come and I'll come. Think of that for just a moment. If it's you, I'll come. Prove it. He said, come. And Peter did. And he begins to walk on the surface of the water to prove that it is who he says it was. Wow. And then what happens? He begins to see the storm. He begins to recognize, what am I doing? What is wrong with me? His thinking seems to catch up with him about three steps in everywhere he goes. He like does it instinctively. Okay, I'm going to do it. I'm doing it. And he sort of instinctively recognizes there's a problem here. I am violating the laws of physics at this point. And in addition, I'm scared to begin with. And he remembered his circumstances, so to speak. It's sort of like he came back into perspective. And what happens at that moment? He begins to sink. He begins to drown. He's scared. He says, hey, save me. And Jesus is right there. And he grabs him. He says, I'm here. Trust me. Know who I am. But here's the beauty of that picture. That is so very, very beautifully describes our relationship with God. Our relationship with Christ, where we are saying, God, I know this is true about you. I believe that, but I'm scared because my circumstances are terrifying. And I look around at my life and I think, oh, can you be true? Can it be so? Is it really you, God? And Jesus says, it is me. Walk. Come. Keep your focus, your attention, your mindset. Keep it fixed on me. I will keep you in perfect peace. Come. And we, at some points, we find ourselves beginning that. We're saying, okay, here I go. And yet, somehow, along the way, we often find ourselves beginning to lose sight, beginning to lose perspective. And what was required? A return to the beginning. God, I need you. Oh, okay, honey, you're still there. I need you. That's the focus. That's the value or point of rehearsing what is true about God. And we're talking a lot about that rehearsal. That rehearsing of what is true about God in the midst of struggle provides such hope and such joy. We're calling this series Out of Darkness. And one of the reasons why I wanted to title it that, the examination of this letter in particular, is because there is a lot of darkness in the context of this letter. There's a lot going on historically that kind of gives us a little bit of a picture of how in particular Peter is writing, or why, I suppose, he's writing this letter to the churches that he describes. There's a very specific thing he wants to accomplish as he pens this letter, to help them understand the point of what they're doing. This is sort of the point of the gospel in the middle of exile, or in the middle of struggle, or in the darkness that is our culture. What do I do? How do I live in this life? in the middle of struggle, in the middle of trouble, in the middle of persecution, in the middle of all that I have, in exile from what I know I am actually supposed to be. How do I live this life? And there are three portions to this letter. There are three sections that sort of give us this synopsis of how we work our way through understanding how we're to live in light of the gospel in exile, so to speak, in the middle of a perverse generation, right? How do we do that? And that's a question that we really have to answer. Why do we have to answer that? Because the alternative has already been described to us in Jude. If we don't understand what the point is of the gospel, if we don't understand why we're doing what we're doing, if we don't get the whole point, if we're like, okay, look, you know what? What's the value of this thing? Why do I even bother? Eventually, you will find yourself further and further and further into apostasy or apostate understanding, where the gospel no longer has the force of focus. It is something that you lose sight of, and before long you're sort of falling into all kinds of error. But when we remind ourselves of what is true, when we gaze upon the face of God, we become reflectors of the light of the gospel in the midst of the darkness. And that's what we're called to accomplish. So this is the value or the point of this letter, that it gives the readers, the church in particular, some pointers, some valuable helps in how to go about living in light of Christ, in light of the gospel, in the middle of darkness. We are to come out of the darkness. And so that's what we're going to talk about. We talked last week about the name in particular of the author. Now, I was pretty established in my assessment of Peter being the author, and I am still. For those of you that want to know, is there any question here? For the longest time, there was none. There was almost no question that Peter was the author of these letters. Why? Well, first off, it has his name. There are plenty of people in critical scholarship who say, well, just because it has his name doesn't mean he wrote it. There are some that would say that, was that a laugh? Okay. I thought either that or you're beatboxing. I wasn't sure which. So you have the situation where you say we've got this guy Peter, and he may have written it, but there's, especially in the last probably 200 years or so, there's been this expanding question mark about whether or not he was the author. And one thing I do want to point out before we move past this is one very neat piece of information that sort of helps put this together. One of the reasons why people doubt Peter as the author of 1 Peter now is because they say the nature of the letter, the way it's written, it's beautiful. It's really, frankly, incredibly well-established Greek. I mean, this is really well-written. And in light of what we know about Peter, well, that seems impossible, right? I mean, come on, Peter, Galilean fisherman. How is it that he knew how to write something so magnificent? How was it that he theologically was able to sort of establish something so really beautiful? And especially when you compare it to what, and we will do this, when you compare the way that 1 Peter is written with the way that 2 Peter is written, there seems to be a little bit of a discrepancy in terms of the language. It's like, this one seems pretty impressive in terms of its value, its literary value, as opposed to the second book of Peter. So you're like, okay, so why, the second letter, why are these different? Is there any explanation? So is that uncomfortable for you? Does that make you like, oh man, wow, oh, maybe Peter didn't write it. Huh? Does that give you any sense of fear or trembling? Right. And he mentions Silvanus as being an assistant or an amanuensis, perhaps. And so there's a degree to which what we may be seeing, and this makes sense in light of the fact that we have other places where Peter does this. He even says in this, Mark's with me, my son Mark. Now, we don't know for sure who he's speaking of, but there are multiple instances when we see Peter using assistants from other places to help write, which, by the way, is really cool. If you think about it, it's actually pretty neat. Because what does that demonstrate about Peter? What's his ambition? What's his point? If it's true, and this is a big if, that he's using someone to assist him in the writing of this thing, what does that demonstrate about him? Who is Peter? Culturally, who is Peter in this context? Who is he? Who would the believers or the church think of him as? He's the leader. He's the head honcho, right? Some people would even say he is the Pope, but we won't go there. But, you know, the idea that he is the main dude, right? But yet here he is sort of establishing or sort of putting together this whole system where he says, I'm going to write this letter and it's important and I want to make sure that I get things as clear as possible, and so I'm going to use assistance. I'm going to use help to make sure that this makes clear, good sense. That's a very humble thing for a guy like that to do. And yet, you know, if he chose to, that'd be pretty significant. So regardless of that fact, the clarity with which he speaks and the things that he says make sense in doctrinally. I mean, in terms of who we know he is, there's plenty of ways that we could say with pretty absolute certainty, in my estimation, and we could go more into this if we chose to. I don't know if it'd be super valuable for us. It seems logical or likely that Peter was the one who was at the very least telling or informing somebody to how to write or how to put together the thoughts that are presented here in the book of 1 Peter. He was called the rock or the little pebble. Remember, Jesus gave him that name change when he first encountered him. Simon Barjona, I will call you Peter or Cephas. I'm going to change your name from what it was, one who hears but doesn't always listen, to Peter, little rock, one who will be established sort of as a foundational part of my system, of the thing that I'm establishing now on earth, the church. He became a leader, a key player in the establishment of God's church. He was what was one of the first things that he accomplished after the ascension of Jesus? He preached at Pentecost. That's significant, is it not? He was one of the first preachers at Pentecost. That's amazing. He was the guy who spoke, and how many people, thousands of people, came to understand the truth of the nature of the gospel. This guy is significant. 1 John 1:40-42, one of the two who heard John speak and follow Jesus was Andrew, Simon's brother. We talked about this last week, and he found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We found the Messiah," which means the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus, and Jesus looked or gazed on him. It's almost as if he looked through him, and he said, "You are Simon, the son of Jonah, and you shall be called Cephas," or Peter. And that means the rock. It looked at him, looked through him, and that rock, that sense of the fact that you're going to change in your very essence because you're going to encounter the truth of the gospel, and it's going to transform your understanding. We see at multiple places where sometimes his understanding did seem to sort of waver a little bit. But the thing that's so neat about Peter is that he constantly, when he was reminded of truth, he came back to truth. And there's a beauty in that. And we begin to see the hope of that process of the discipleship that goes on with Peter. The first time we see church was in the New Testament. It was Peter at Caesarea Philippi. When he professes the truth about the nature of Christ, he says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Jesus asks that. And they say, "Well, some say you're John the Baptist, others say you're Jeremiah, Elijah, or one of the prophets." And then Jesus says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter makes that confession, that rock-solid confession of the truth of the gospel. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. I say you are Peter, and upon this rock, or the rock of your confession, will I build my church, and the gates of hell, the very gates of hell, will not prevail against it." I love how this would have called to the heart of Peter. Because again, what do you notice even in terms of how Jesus is referring to him? He starts by his old name and he says, "You are Simon, son of Jonah, but you're also Peter." He brings both of them to bear. He says that the nature that you were, the way that I've built you, your character, your essence, we talked about this last week. God designed into Peter a strong desire to protect and to defend. And God says, "Great, let's start with the essential, the gospel. What is the gospel? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." That is a true, honest, rock-solid confession. And that rock is going to be on that confession, everything is going to be built. And the very gates of hell will not prevail against that confession. This is, again, so encouraging. This is so encouraging for Peter because it gives him something that is strong and sturdy. This is a confession, even sort of like what we were doing earlier on, where we say, "What is God? He is unchanging. He is true. He is glorious. He is hopeful." This is strong and unchanging, and that confession sort of compels us to recognize we have something strong to defend. He's not building him on Peter. He's building on the rock of the confession, right? We've kind of talked about that last week. So additionally, we want to talk a little bit about the church before we dive in too far, because again, knowing the nature of the individual and also knowing the nature of the church or the churches that it was written to helps to give us a sense when we're reading this. Many times people will take letters like these and they will build pet doctrines out of these passages. And sometimes that's in violation to even what we know to be true about the nature of the churches that are being written to or the nature of the author. So we want to have a good sense of who it was that wrote it and also a good sense of the people that was being written to. So in this case, the church appears to be the persecuted church. And why do we say that? How many of you have read 1 Peter so far? Have you guys read it? So do you get a sense from reading that there's a strong sense of the persecution of the church? Certainly, it appears that there are multiple places within that letter that implies that there's going to be this growing sense of trouble or trial that comes up against the church. They are a persecuted church. It's likely that this letter was written sometime between 64 and 68 AD. That seems likely in terms of what we see historically. Based on the timing, the style of Greek, and the audience, it also seems that Peter was written to encourage the French churches after Paul's death. And this would be interesting, and particularly when we consider the idea of the fact that it was written by Peter. One of the big arguments that's raised against Peter as the author is the fact that he's writing to Gentiles, or he at least seems to be writing to a number of Gentiles. What was Peter's sort of official position in the church? What was he referred to? The apostle to the Jews, right? That was sort of the thing that was understood, so to speak. is that he was the one who was sort of primarily sent to the Jews to present to them the fact that Messiah was in fact the Christ, in spite of the fact that they killed him. Whereas Paul was sort of the apostle to the Gentiles. And so some people say, oh, hold on, this couldn't have been written by Peter, because everyone knows there's no way he'd be writing to Gentiles, which I think is kind of silly, first off, because the implication is that there's some type of very specific divide here. You know, the non-compete clause, where you say, you go on your side, you deal with your people, I'll deal with my people. Does that fit with what we know of the gospel? Frankly, not at all. So that in itself sort of is a problem to begin with. But additionally, one of the things that seems to be occurring in this particular letter is that there's this strong encouragement that's offered to the church, and it's written in somewhat of a Pauline manner. It actually has a little bit of that Pauline flavor to it at some level. You're like, well, why would he be writing sort of in the style of Paul? Why would he be presenting information? Well, perhaps it's the style of God, first off. But beyond that, even if he is adopting some of the Pauline way of writing, it may very well be that he's trying to encourage a bunch of churches, because if it's true that it was written during this period of time, Paul dies. So if you think of that for a moment and you imagine in your mind, what would happen if the apostle that sort of was establishing all of these churches, he's the one that is preaching and teaching truth, he's the one that's going around proclaiming the hope of the gospel, if your founding pastor gets killed by Rome, what are you going to do? You're going to freak out. You're like, what is going on? What is happening in our world? We lost Paul. And there's going to be a very deep sense of sort of what now that's going to come upon the church. Wouldn't we agree that that would sort of be naturally the inclination of that church? Logic would say that yes, that's the case. And so in this instance, if it is true that this letter was written, it may very well have been the death of Paul that compelled Peter to write this letter. Almost the occasion, so to speak, of his writing, he says, I am going to send you this to encourage you that in spite of what you're seeing, Paul told you this and you know it, and it doesn't make it less true because he's dead. In fact, what we know is true is not based on Paul or my understanding, but it's based on the hope of the gospel. He's beginning to present this idea, and he's doing it in a way that sort of is reminiscent, perhaps, of that. Now again, one of the things that he writes, he describes in very particular terms in verses 1 through 2 who the audience is for the church. Those churches in particular don't appear to be places that Paul spent any significant personal time in. So these are sort of churches that are like the second and third tier, even away from where Paul had spent time. So he invested his time and energy in some very particular large cities. He made a point of going to the sort of the epicenters of the cultural area. And from there, he encouraged people to branch out, to establish churches and to establish truth and to set up doctrine. And so some of these churches that are sort of on the fringe, they may have themselves sort of been struggling at some level with the fact that Paul is gone. They haven't ever even met him, and yet now he's dead. And so there's a degree to which it could be also based on the fact that these churches struggled because they were sort of on the fringe. Hope is one of the key messages, the key elements or themes that you're going to see in this. And you see it throughout. Chapter 1, verse 6, 3, 13 to 17, 4, 12 to 19. These passages are so filled with hope. They're permeated by the idea of hope in the midst of persecution. Because without that hope, it really is very easy to lose your focus, to lose sight of the point. When persecution or trouble comes, it's very simple, very easy for us in our human nature to sort of slip away from what we know to be true. And so Peter is calling out to these individuals and saying, have hope in the midst of the trouble. Persecution seems to be growing, and the church is also experiencing some of that pain that's coming from that growing persecution. And that persecution is really hard to nail down. There are some people that make an argument that this also could not be written by Peter, because Peter died before there was an official persecution of the church. And they say, well, you know, there was an official persecution that came in 90 or something, AD, and so it couldn't have been Peter. It had to be somebody using his name sort of to garner respect for their writing, because there was no official persecution. And I kind of, again, find that somewhat humorous, because just because there's no official persecution doesn't mean there's not persecution, right? We're like, well, you know, if there's not official persecution, then it really can't be called that. Well, that's silly and foolish, and we know it. There is a growing sense in which persecution was coming. In fact, one of the things that we recognize about the persecution against the church, we've seen this in so many other letters, especially the ones that Paul is writing, and even the one that Jude wrote, he talked about persecution. Not all the persecution was even necessarily coming from outside the church. There was even some persecution or struggle or strife that was coming within the church itself. There are multiple places where persecution could begin to arise. It could be the general population as well. One thing that's true about Christianity, and we'll see this in one of the writings of a historian from that era, Christianity was viewed with huge suspicion almost immediately by the population at large. The Roman occupation, they allowed people to have their own religions, but they were very careful about how those parameters worked. They did not want those systems to offend the general populace. They couldn't have any kind of offensive practice that would make it sort of you know, weird or unusual in a way that would offend the sensibilities or the morality of the general populace. It could not have any subversive element to the government. I mean, there's all kinds of stipulations that they placed over this. They said, you can have your gods, we're fine with that. You can have your own religious systems, but don't you dare cross these boundaries. And Christianity, in some people's estimation, did cross that boundary. One thing that seems to be sort of, and this is more from extra-biblical sources, but one of the things that you see even in that context is that some people were saying that Christianity was built around or centered on cannibalism. Why would they have said that? Because of the Last Supper. They said one of their chief things that these groups do is they eat flesh and drink blood. I mean, and you think about that, frankly, we're very familiar with that concept. We're like, well, yeah, of course, it's the Lord's Supper. But this is a brand new idea. And what happened when Jesus first inaugurated that? When he said, if you do not share in me, if you do not eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in me. What happened to the Jews? They're like, whoa, dude, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm offended by that. This is cannibalism, man. I'm out. This is weird stuff. And they begin to separate themselves. So why wouldn't it also have the same effect on the general Roman population? They're like, man, this thing's a little weird. They've got cannibalism as part of their deal. Additionally, they had this whole idea of being able to share things in common. There's always talk of love, and some people would say, and this is actually, again, in extra-biblical sources, they would say that this particular cult was primarily just orgies. They have these things called love feasts. Man, we all know what goes on there, and they didn't know, but they begin to spread these ideas, right? Again, what does that make logical sense in light of what we know about culture? Yeah. If it's exclusive, or if it implies that it has truth, then people are going to view it with suspicion, and they're going to hear things, and without understanding, they're going to think, this is crazy, this is bad stuff. So that persecution was already beginning to establish itself pretty deeply, even in the general population, as they're trying to understand what this idea of Christianity is. This Jewish carpenter is now the center of their argument, and he was executed by Rome. So obviously we know he was guilty. The assumption is they lived very much in a similar position, I think, that we do sometimes. Well, the government killed him, so he must have done something wrong. And so there's a sense in which that itself, even the offense of the death of the founder, would imply to some Roman audience, yeah, this doesn't sound like a good deal. This probably has some subversive sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Revolutionary tendencies, I guess. So there's, I mean, all three of those. If you think about even those three, those are all logical conclusions that the general population could even make against the church. And so you have this persecution that's growing. It does not have to be official persecution from the official government in order for it to be very effective on the church. But one thing that we do know is that, and this is according to Tacitus, the Roman historian, we do know that during this period of time, Nero was around. Now, some people say Nero himself was sort of inaugurating an official persecution of the church. It's not entirely true. It wasn't a recognized persecution. It wasn't as if to say this is the edict or decree, that this is something that is going to be persecuted. And yet, that doesn't mean that he didn't participate in persecution against the church. We know he did. So this Roman historian gives us some information, and we're just going to read it quickly so we can get a sense of the culture that the church found itself in. So he says, neither human resource nor imperial generosity nor appeasement of guilt eliminated the sinister suspicion that the fire had been deliberately started. Now we start to get a sense of the historical context. What do we know about this fire that hypothetically was started? Ever heard the idiom, Nero fiddled while Rome burned? Well, he probably didn't fiddle because they didn't have violins there as far as I know, but something, some type of musical instrument. The argument is that he was seen sort of pleased with the fact that Rome was burning. Do we know what was the motivation potentially? And this is just history. Why would Nero have wanted Rome to burn? Probably not. There's some arguments at that, but I don't buy that one quite so much. I don't know that he had that sinister of a mindset against Christianity per se, although I'm sure the devil used that long term. I actually think, because if you look at in particular historically what burned, it's the ghetto. The ghetto burned, and what happened after it was burned? They built temples and beautiful sort of ornamentation to Nero, to the Caesar, to the one who we worship. I think he was sort of inaugurating this sort of purge of the bad places. And so in his head, he's like, it's ugly. I don't like how it looks. And so he's like, light a match. Let's burn this thing. And people died because of that. And that's perhaps why he was pleased. In two different instances, historians say that it seems like the fire was put out and then started again. So there's a sense in which he's sort of trying to get himself some space. This is sort of the government run amok, right? He's just trying to take the property, so to speak, so that they could take advantage of that space for themselves. Well, you know, and in his mind, he's perfectly justified in that. And yet there's some suspicion. What would happen if that happens in our modern context? If you start to kick people out of places, tear down their houses and build, you know, your own, the things you want, well, people are going to get very unhappy, right? It's not a good thing to do. And so Nero probably overestimated his ability to sort of get away with this. Oh, it was just a fire, natural occurrence, act of God, we can't deal with it. Tell you what, let's build something here. People begin to be suspicious. There's multiple places where suspicion was raised against Nero, and that suspicion could not be eliminated, that the fire had been deliberately started. To stop the rumor, Nero made scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians. This in parentheses here is added, right? So the historian said the notoriously depraved Christians. Like, wait, they're not notoriously depraved. What are we talking about? Well, again, think about what we're talking about and logically what they would be considered. Oh man, these Christians, they're depraved people, man. They have all kinds of weird practices and all this stuff. It was probably them. They probably started it. It's probably part of their religious thing, you know. They had all these candles going maybe and they started a fire. So they're notoriously depraved. Their originator, Christ, had been executed by Tiberius's reign by the procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate, who's actually the prefectus, not the procurator. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition has broken out again. The deadly superstition has broken out again. In spite of the initial, oh, it was the Christians that did it, it seems that the persecution or the advance of the gospel was continuing in spite of that, not just in Judea where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital, all right? They're like, well, it makes sense that it'd be in Rome. All these, you know, of course it's going to be here. First, Nero had the self-admitted Christians arrested. Then on their information, large numbers of others were condemned. Not so much for starting fires as because of their hatred for the human race. Their hatred for the human race. That's supposedly what they were judged on. Their deaths were made amusing, dressed in wild animal skins. They were torn to pieces by dogs, or crucified, or made into torches to be set on fire after dark as illumination. Despite their guilt as Christians and the ruthless punishment it deserves, the victims were pitied, for it was felt that they were being sacrificed to one man's brutality rather than to the national interest. So over time, people began to recognize, you know what? This seems a little too convenient. And the fact of the matter is, especially with the Christians, you know, they were being blamed for a lot of what had occurred, but people aren't stupid usually. I mean, over time they begin to sort of see the reality of what appears to be going on, and there was a growing sense of the fact that, yeah, this probably wasn't them. But in spite of it, Nero in particular was very adamant to try to cast the blame on them and to cause them to become persecuted. So it was in this environment that the church in particular that was written to, this dispersion of church was written. Which again is, I mean, you read that and you think that is mind-boggling, that level of persecution. And frankly, I know there's a lot of people that want to compellingly tell you stories of how, in particular, God's church was persecuted and how good we have it. And I'll grant that's true. Before we move past this, we cannot forget to remind ourselves of the fact that we do, in this country and in our culture, have a remarkable privilege. We have very little persecution in the official sense of the word. In comparison, I mean, and that's not the point here. The point is not to compare and say, man, why are you guys all sad? It was harder for them. That really doesn't go anywhere. That's not the point. And yet, in spite of it, we can recognize and acknowledge that it would be hard. It would be remarkably difficult to be hope-filled in this kind of an environment. It would be very difficult to have that happening, to having your leaders exterminated, to see this growing distrust for your system, to recognize that the hope that you had initially is going to have to come against persecution, to have that in your mind and to think, wow, I'm supposed to remain faithful to this thing? Oh, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can go on. And Peter writes his letter to these folks in particular to give them a sense of hope. This is a map of the area that it was written to. So in verse 1 and 2, it gives us a sense sort of the nature of the churches that this is written to. It's considered a general epistle rather than a specific epistle. In other words, it was intended to sort of be shared amongst these churches. And again, we've already established these churches are in a very unique spot. One of the things that's interesting here, and this is just, again, it's speculative at some level, but it can be very informative as we look at what in particular is going on in these churches. So they're called elect, those of the dispersion, those who have been moved, and they use the dispersion in very particular terms. And so immediately my mind has peaked a little. I think, why are they called the dispersion? Right? Why are they called this particular group, and why are they given a name? And there are plenty of reasons why that could be. It could be that Paul is just calling us sort of aliens, so to speak, in our walk here on earth. We don't belong here. We've been dispersed, so to speak. Or perhaps it's the persecution. Many people say this dispersion was the result of the persecution. There was a spreading of people, and so they were dispersed. They were spread abroad because of the persecution, which frankly makes a lot of sense in terms of how God tends to do business. He tends to spread his truth, and even sometimes through persecution. But there may be another explanation, and this is one that was offered that's interesting. One of the things that one of the rulers of Rome did in order to help alleviate some of the growing influence, especially of religious systems, would be to actually force people to go to these outposts. If you are sort of getting a following within the, and it's whether it's political or religious, if you're starting to garner a following within the capital, he would say, "I'm going to assign you to become settlers out in this outpost here. We want to put some Roman influence there." And he would actually take individuals who, it's sort of a punishment actually. It would be kind of like you are being expelled or dispersed from your homeland, and you're going to have to go live in this other place. And so it's possible that one of the things that the leadership of Rome did is that they began to, when they discovered these pockets of Christianity, he would say officially, "No, you go here." And in fact, the five spaces that are listed, the five places that this dispersion is listed, we know historically that at least one of these rulers actually did send Christians to these five places. So it may also be that some of who he's writing to is people who have been in Rome who were forced to leave. And so in addition to the fact that you have persecution against yourself, but you also now are isolated. And frankly, isolation can be really discouraging, where you no longer have the fellowship of the body or the believers. You're no longer able to assemble together as the manner of some is. You know, they're gone, and they think, "What do I do? I'm all by myself in the middle of nowhere. No one understands me. I don't have fellowship." And Peter could be writing to encourage these people as well. This may have been an official disbursement of the church by the leadership. Regardless of that fact, he's writing to encourage or to draw the hearts together of all of these people, these churches who are under persecution of various levels, and say, "Be encouraged. There is hope in the gospel." Letter is addressed to Christians in central and northern provinces of Asia Minor. So this is where we would see sort of modern-day Turkey. This is where they're primarily situated, and this is where the letter was written. It's addressed to the elect, who are the elect exiles of the dispersion, right? It is apparent that the readers were Christians of both Jewish and Gentile background. And so there again, we recognize that there's a sense to which, you know, the argument, well, Peter couldn't be writing this because there are some Gentiles mixed in. That's foolish. And in fact, even with Peter, what do we know about Peter with relationship to Gentiles? How did he respond to that? Did he have any interaction historically with Gentiles? What interaction did he have? When did he have to face that the issue of interaction with Gentiles? He was sent to Cornelius, right? Who was a Gentile. And how did he know he was sent? I mean, he had a whole vision from God, a sheep coming down with all kinds of animals. And I mean, he had all kinds of very, very vivid, frankly, call to continue to expound the gospel and to extend it beyond even just the Jews. So, this is the nature of the writing. This is where we encounter it. This is the way that we see it. And this is, I suppose, where we're gonna stop here for today, because we've got a birthday party that comes here at 12:30. So we gotta, wait, 12:30? Oh, I'm like, it's way past 12:30. And then I realized they didn't turn the clock back yet. What a relief. Man, I went a lot longer than I thought I did. All right. So one of the things that I want us to do, and I would encourage you to, again, spend some time and energy and effort. There's value in sort of placing yourself historically into context. Again, there's more to this than just, it's not just that it meant something to them in that season. It means something to us now. But for a moment, spend some time and energy thinking about how God chose to extend the gospel and the hope of the gospel into the context of these believers. And as we start underway next week, I mean, we'll probably get all the way through half of verse 1 next week at least. I mean, we're going to really move quickly. But when we work our way through this stuff, I want you to not lose sight of the historical nature, the context of what's occurring here, because it will certainly inform, even in verse 1, it will inform some of your understanding of what is going on in the hearts and the minds of the hearer. It can't mean something now that it didn't mean then. We understand how they were thinking or encountering the truth, and how does then that relate to our experience? And I would also, if there's nothing else that you gain or glean from this, I would spend some time this week praying faithfully for God's church. Because we have no idea the struggle that our brothers and sisters that we claim to have fellowship in God with, we have no concept of how much they are struggling and dying for the sake of the gospel. And I find myself so simple-minded in my prayers for them. I am burdened, frankly, in particular because David Abernathy has called me more than a few times in the last month to talk about the persecuted church in particular with some of the things that are going on with ISIS and some of this other stuff. And I think, why are we so quick in our culture to forget and to lose sight of the fact that these people are under immense pressure? Pray for hope. Pray for hope. Don't necessarily pray for rescue. And I'm not saying you can't, but hope is the bigger rescue. Because in the midst of persecution, there can be hope. And the thing that's beautiful about the prayer for hope, at least that's occurred in my heart, is that I discover in the process of praying for hope in their trouble, I begin to remind myself of what is true about God for me too. I begin to see the face of God and the glory of God. I am rehearsing what is true for God, for the believers that are in that context. And I find my own focus realigned. I think, God, you are glorious and hope-filled. I will praise you because you are all that you claim to be, unchanging, forgiving, faithful, glorious, holy. That is who you are, and what you promised you will accomplish. And I know it's true for them, and it's also true for me. If it's true for them, then it's certainly true for me. God uses even persecution of others to remind us of hope for ourselves, but also for the promises of God and for what he's assured about his church. Is anything anybody wants to add? I know we're still kind of in the historical nature of it, so we haven't really dove in, so to speak, into the actual content just yet. But is there anything that anybody wants to add to this? Is this true? I know you're like, well, it seems true. Anything additional that anybody wants to put in here? Okay, good. Spend time this week thinking and praying for God's church, yourself, and those that are in our context immediately and then across the globe. And then also read 1 Peter and get ready. Next week's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it. Okay, let's pray. God, thank you so much for the privilege that we have of being part of this hope. God, you are so glorious. You are so good. And you established that in such clear terms in the book of 1 Peter. God, thank you so much for the beautifully written, the incredible truth that's contained in this letter. God, I pray that you will apply it to our hearts and to our minds and to our action. God, I don't want this to just sit idly in our heads. I long for the time when this truth becomes part of our very fabric and nature. God, I pray that you will use this study to give us hope. God, I pray that you will use our examination of this truth to remind us of your glory and of the truth that you possess. And Lord, I pray that you will do all of this for your glory. It's in your name that we pray. All of these things. Amen.